Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Thomas Robert Simpson from the club's member-led arts forum and your chair for this evening. I'm also the artistic director of the Afro Solo Arts Festival, opening its 19th season tonight. This program is presented in association with the festival. We welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite you to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce Sherry Young, the founder and artistic director, founder and the executive director, formerly artistic director and executive director, now just executive director, of San Francisco's African American Shakespeare Company. I'll now turn it over to Sherry, tonight's moderator.
Thank you, Thomas, and welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I love to see such a diverse audience here, here at the Commonwealth Club. So we have an illustrious group of panel members of artists of different mediums, and what I would love to do is actually go down the line and have them give a brief description of who they are, and I think when we're talking about art and race, it does have a validity of where you begin in life. So tell us who you are and give us briefly a little bit of history about yourself and your art.
I'm Joyce Gordon, founder of Joyce Gordon Gallery. I am Joyce Gordon, founder of Joyce Gordon Gallery in Oakland. I have been there for 10 years. Prior to that, I was a student at Arts and Crafts in Oakland. In design.
Good evening. My name is Marcus Shelby. I'm a composer, an arranger, educator, father, activist. I was born in Alaska, and that was because of the Vietnam War. That's where my dad was stationed. But my roots are from Memphis, Tennessee, and that's where most of my family is from. The other side of my family is from Mississippi. So a lot of my development, a lot of my raising came through the experiences of my parents who lived during the Civil Rights Movement and taught a lot about racial history to me, about what happened in the South, and about how to take those lessons and apply them to what's happening today.
Well, honored to be on this panel with these folks. These are great people. Thank you, Thomas. My name is Sean San Jose. I work for Intersection for the Arts. I'm one of the staff members there. I'm a program director of the performance program, so I get to work with a whole host of collaborators in and outside of the arts. Also work with resident groups, Campo Santo Theater Company, Living Word Project, Erica Chung Performance Project, Mr. Shelby for many years, and I was born and raised here in San Francisco and have happily spent most of my life with a little bouncing around here.
Great. Well, that was brief. Thank you so much. I'm always worried about the time, so I'm going to watch that clock like a hawk. Before we get into art and race, I always think it's important that we sort of have your guys' personal experience of when you first noticed race. For me, I was about 7 years old. I'll start with me first, and then I'll let you guys talk. I was about 7 years old. I was at Lake Tahoe. I had my hair washed, and back in the day, we were doing pressing of the hair. You didn't get perms as a child. You got your hair pressed. Well, this time, I didn't have a pressed hair. So I was out with my cousins in a grocery store, and I had my two Afro puffs in a little, you know, and this little white girl was like, "Mommy, look at the girl with the funny hair." And I turned around to see who she was talking about, and then I realized she was talking about me. And I never knew that my hair was funny until that moment. And I think that was the first time that I noticed there was a succinct difference in race, because this little girl saw me differently, but I didn't see her differently. And that was my first reaction of having something different occur through someone else's eyes, of how they viewed me. So I would love to know if you, my panelists, when was your first time of noticing race, either as a child, as an adult? What was your first experience?
I think my first experience was probably about the second grade in Oakland at Bella Vista School. during Halloween when you dressed in costumes and you march around the block and hold hands. And this little girl, this little white girl, we were fine until she saw her parents, and she said, "I can't hold your hand." And I was like, "Oh, okay." So I think that was my very first experience. Hmm.
Well, I'm very fortunate. My mother is a school teacher, and from the beginning that I can remember being able to talk or read, she was telling me stories about history, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth. I grew up with a very strong sense of my history, and so when I became more conscious that there were other races and there was this environment that existed, I believe I was in Memphis, Tennessee. And one thing I noticed was a large part of Memphis is still segregated. You have a large black community that lives on one side of town, and you have a large white community that lives on another side of town. This was maybe 30 years ago where I consciously saw this. Hmm. And one of the things I noticed was in the black neighborhood, you know, you had blacks that worked as doctors, as nurses, as police officers, working in the bank. You go to the 7-Eleven, there was black people there. Everywhere I went, I saw the community there, right there in my face. And when I came to California, it's almost like the script almost flipped. I didn't really see that present in the 70s. And so I started to really think about why did that exist. Made me think about the Harlem Renaissance, when segregation actually was the law of the land, and blacks owned their own businesses, movie theaters, and there was a certain thriving of the arts, particularly in New York at this time, and what happened after the Harlem Renaissance ended. And it reminded me of seeing all these role models in my neighborhood at one time in Memphis, Tennessee, but then coming to California and not seeing that. So that was the beginning of me asking questions, trying to come up with an understanding of how society gets divided like that. Hmm. I was very young.
That's deep. It's messed up, though, because I think it is, like you were saying, I think school or the world tells us. I'm sure there was an event similar to that. I grew up here. I grew up in the city. I grew up in the Mission District. So this is before it was all sold off, and it was a little bit more mixed, and it was a little bit more, much more working class. And so I honestly grew up, I can say that maybe I've changed my perspective on it, but I actually didn't really think about it. I'm also from a background of a lot of different islanders. So our family is very mixed just from gate. So you have Easter at my grandmother's, everyone's everything. But family. And I think our block was like that a lot. And I think what it was, remember back in the day before, they used to have you fill out the thing and would say, what's your background? Mm-hmm. And I think that was the first time where I had to consciously trip on it. It was probably something like white, black, other. It might not have been that. You know, it might have been white, black, Mexican, other, or something like that. I can't. But there was definitely a big old box with other, and I was like, I get this. And I remember I had to bring it to my mom and be like, which one are we supposed to fill out? And then that sort of landed in my head that someone else in the world wants to know this information that we consciously at that time didn't really feel. And I think that sort of just rolled around in my head for years and years. And then I think I got into books real early. And I remember when I read Native Son, I must have read that thing like cover to cover when I read it. But then it exploded the world for me. And then you went, this all has a context. This all has consequences. This all has a history to it. And I think there was something about, I don't know, there's something really crazy about that story where it's the eyes of the world that tell you what you are and tells you that race exists.
Great, thank you. So it seems like we all have different experiences, but it's outward people telling us how to identify ourselves. And for Marcus, I thought it was very interesting that you brought up that when you came to California, which is supposed to be very diverse, that you had a whole different reaction, that actually the South seemed more together in their identity than California. So it was an understanding for you?
Well, that's because I didn't come from Memphis to, say, Oakland. Mm-hmm. I went to Sacramento, and I went to a pretty white neighborhood. And so so that was my unique experience there. As I got older, that wasn't the only thing I saw in California. But it was the first time I saw almost the opposite which existed in Memphis, because these, like I said, these were role models to me. When you see the diversity of employment, of leadership, of community leaders that were in that environment in Memphis, and that had a very strong effect, because you can go, I can be that, I can be that, I can do that, we can do it all, you know. But when you don't see that, then you don't know what your possibilities are, and you don't know what you can make of yourself. And so that's the difference that I discovered.
Now, I would like to know how race has affected your work as an artist. If you've sort of understood how people are perceiving you from the outside, if you're trying to grasp an understanding of your place in the world, I would love to hear from, and let me start with Sean. Let me go down the other way. Sean, I would love to hear from you how race has affected your work as an artist and your drive to see something different in the performing arts world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's everything that I do. I think it's everything that we do. It's, you know, what is it, the most dichotomous sort of statement, right? Because it is everything. Race is everything in the United States of America. And then yet at the same time, you want to tell stories of the world around you. But certainly for me, we started a group, Campo Santo, to reflect the world that we lived in. And I think the world that we live in does not get reflected back to us in an accurate picture at all, in any way whatsoever, in any kind of percentage that is remotely in the arena, you know. And so I think if you have a chance to tell stories or to pick up stories and share those stories, for me, there would be nothing else. There would be nothing else to do. I wouldn't do it if I couldn't tell the pictures of the neighborhood. I think it also comes, you know, it's right that we started by talking about how we grew up. You know, I used to, from when we were very little, me and my brother used to catch the bus from, like, and we lived way over in the Mission, and we would have to go on to the other side to the Fillmore, and we would take the 24 to Visadero. If you take the 24 to Visadero, it goes through the Mission, Castro, Western Addition, Viz, when Visadero used to be to Visadero. And that is basically going to be my thing the whole night. When the city was the city. I'm so sad. And then you get to see, that's your world, though, right? Mm-hmm. Your bus ride is your world. And if it looks like that, if it sounds like that, then that's what it is. And so if I'm going to read a book, or if I'm going to play music, or if I'm going to tell stories, it should be that. Like, I never grew up in a world that was downtown in the sense that it was ballet, opera, and theater in that sense. And so when I got introduced to the world of performing arts, theater in particular, I was probably 17 or something, and I just thought that's what it was. Wow, there's this thing where you can tell pictures that look like the pictures of the world. How neat, how cool, what a great opportunity, because certainly turning on the television, I mean, come on. You know, there's nothing out there like that. It's a little bit like, what if you can imagine, what radio station did you listen to growing up? And me thinking, we used to have, like, great radios, KDIA, K-Soul, like regular K-Soul back in the day, K-Jazz and K-Poo. And if I sort of, like, that's what the world sounds like to me, because that's what we listened to when we grew up. And if you, even today, like, the rest of those stations are gone except for KPU, right? And if you listen to what their programming is, well, I think it's pretty cool. It's a pretty good reflection of what the Bay is, probably, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and you could put it into little categories and whatever. You know, you have salsa on the Saturdays, and then you have the reggae on, and then the deep soul on Tuesday nights, whatever, whatever. But that's, in terms of storytelling, that's all I know. Like, that's all we would ever, that's the only thing there is to do, is to tell the pictures of the world you live in. And I don't know, and I'm me, you know what I mean? And so, like, there's no, what would I do, front? You know, and so you would have to tell a story about, that involves race. But, you know, it's that crazy question. Like, we go in these waves, right? You know, you either push it real hard or you kind of throw your hands up and go, man, I'm tired. But, you know, it's always there, you know. And even when you go, no, decidedly, this story is not going to be about that. The world's still going to see it the way that they're going to see it. So, of course, it's there. And I think it's not like I wrestle with it, but I sort of massage that and navigate that, dance with that question a lot.
Marcus?
Well, I'm very interested in race. I'm interested in it because I'm interested in my history. And from the beginning of my career, 1990, I began down in Los Angeles. I began working on projects mostly by accident, asked to be part of a project that dealt with the Harlem Renaissance. It was my first real project that dealt with race. And so I had to research that. I had to read about it. I had to learn about Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. I had to learn about the work they created and the environment in which they were in. It was fascinating to me because they lived in a very challenging time period, yet they created this amazing work that still informs and inspires us today. And so since then, it's really been about discovering where I came from. And each time I do that, it gives me power. It gives me power to look people in the eye. It gives me power to stand strong. It gives me power to have a lot of hope when it seems like things are hopeless. And so the projects I have chosen have been to discover the heroic and the untalked about stories in our history. Our country, it's inescapable to talk about race. The rugged pioneers who came here in the beginning, one of the things, unfortunately, they also brought slaves. And so from the beginning of our country, slavery existed. And a lot of other things that we cannot forget about because it affected the way our country has developed. Those who have fought for freedom, for such as Harriet Tubman, those who fought for women's rights, those who fought for labor rights, those who fought for all the things that we're realizing now, those who continue to fight for gay rights. And so all of these things are interesting to me because those who were creators, people that inspired me to write music, like Duke Ellington, or Louis Armstrong to play music, or Nina Simone to write about her culture, they use tools that I want to have and that I feel like I've been blessed to have. And so I want to try to speak to what is happening with racial relations today. I mean, and so part of that is discovering what happened in the past. And when they talk about our forefathers or our founding fathers, you know, that means different to different people, all right, because I believe our first four of our first five presidents had slaves. So it's hard for me to consider them founding fathers to me when I know my people were enslaved. And then at some point along the line in the 1850s, they were considered three-fifths a person. So to try to understand, well, should I feel guilty or am I unpatriotic about that? No, I try to discover my history so I know how to articulate what happened. I'm as patriotic as they come. I believe in this country, but also believe that our country has had to make a lot of progress with a lot of sacrifice, but no one wants to talk about that. So I try to create music that talks about that, whether it's the Port Chicago incident that happened in 1944 that took the lives of almost 400 men, most of them African-American, who were kept in a Jim Crow situation loading ammunition bombs, weren't allowed to advance to the next level, be promoted. And then 15 days later, the survivors ordered to go back to work doing the same jobs without any training and then being charged with mutiny. These are stories that don't get told. And so when they say, well, African-American is, this type of talk still goes on today, inferior in mentality, their history isn't as valiant as European culture. You know, I read my history so I can dispute those myths, all right? The story of Harriet Tubman, I keep mentioning that because it's something that really changed my life, how this woman worked with all races. She worked with the Quakers. She was very active in the Civil War, nurse spy. She led raids against Confederate targets. And if that wasn't enough, after the war, she dedicated her life to women's suffrage. And she used music to do that. She used field cries, blues hollers, work songs. She sang spirituals. To me, when I think about what she did, I think about the blues. the best definition for me for the blues is the pursuit of freedom. So if I call myself a musician in America, then I must be well-rooted in the blues if I'm going to understand my culture and be able to help my culture succeed and help my culture to be an important part of the advancement of this country.
Mm-hmm. Joyce, now I know you have a gallery, and I know that you specialize as an artist in textile work, but maybe you can talk about how race has affected either your presentations or exhibits in your gallery, or even your own personal work as a textile artist.
Well, I can speak on one exhibit that I had at the gallery with Ed Dwight and his sculptures.
Hold on, I'm going to give you my microphone. It's a little bit stronger.
Okay.
Try that.
The exhibit that I had at the gallery with Ed Dwight, who does bronze sculptures, and the exhibit, told the story from the African-American experience, beginning with slavery all the way to the jazz musicians of today. And what was so, I guess, profound about this exhibit, it started from with the Maasai Africans to the sharecroppers to the Tuskegee Airmen to the Chicago Buffalo Soldiers. And then this one sculpture that he did was called The Hands That Pick Cotton. And it was suspended, and her hand was holding the ballot to drop in the box. And in her hands, it was just her hands, and I keep saying she, because all I can see or I envision is this woman, this black woman who has worked in the fields and whatever. And finally, the time or the opportunity has come that she can vote. So this was just really, really, really amazing and evoked a lot of sensitivity. For the people who came through the gallery, there was tears, there were people falling on the floor. I mean, it was just really something. And people making the commitment that they would vote, they were going to vote. And this was about 5 to 6 years ago, and here we are again trying to, make some decisions or see that it's everything is fair and everybody gets to vote. It's all these things, these oppositions that are showing up now in terms of voting. So that was a very, very impressive exhibit. And from that, it just shows me how art, painting, sculptures, photography really speaks to because we all humans have sensitivities. And when it speaks to your emotions, it evokes conversation. And from conversation or discussion, somehow, some way, at some time, at some point, hopefully it will dispel some of the myths and the fears and bring the divide or close the divide of different races or cultures a little more together. So.
Thank you. We'll share the mic. Okay. We'll share the mic. I'm glad you mentioned about the sculptures, because that seems to be a piece of work that, changed you or affected you personally. Mm-hmm. And in our lives, there's always something that we find in artwork that changes us. For me, for years and years, you've grown up with, A Raisin in the Sun, the August Wilson Fences plays. I'm a performing arts person, so it's all about theater for me. But there was this one play done at the Lorraine Hansberry Theater, and I don't remember what year. It was called Mammy Louise versus a single professional black woman. I forgot the actual name, but it was a dichotomy between the mammy figure and this professional black woman, and she was on trial. Mammy was on trial for having these images and icons for a history of a lifetime, and how this professional black woman was up in arms that she, as a professional woman, is being dichotomized into this figure. And this play blew me away. I was in tears almost every night, because at the end of this play, this professional black woman came down to the point that she realized Mammy Louise is her and part of her history. There's a part where the set changes into a big slave sail ship, and all the actors on stage are calling out the names of all these slave ships, and I think there's like 40 or 60 names in unison. Mm. There is not a dry eye in the house. I will never forget that play, and that affected me because we're so used to the civil rights and the struggles that I had become desensitized by it. But I would like to know from my panelists, was there any piece of work that affected you personally that made you say, "Ah, you know"?
I actually saw that play.
Oh, you did?
Peter Macon.
Yeah. Oh my God, Peter Macon's awesome. Yes.
Well, since I'm talking, and I like to talk, mine wasn't really a play or a piece of work. But I can tell you like it was yesterday. It was in 1988. I saw Wynton Marsalis perform, and it totally changed my whole vision about this music and about this art form, you know, because I saw myself through him. You know, I'm a little bit younger than him. He's not that old, that much older than me, but he was playing, and he was really articulate about the history of the music. I didn't even really understand the music. I wasn't even there yet in the musical, the vocabulary that his band was playing. But I knew it was something I wanted to do. And I knew that whatever it was the highest quality. And he was speaking very confidently about where he came from. He was dressed nice. And it destroyed all the myths they had about young African-American men. Hmm. And so I'm like, that's what I want to do. Hmm. I want to do that. You know, I don't want to do it like him. I want to do it like I want to do it. But I didn't even know what that meant. But I knew I wanted to be able to stand proud like that. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't really a play or even like in your case where I saw something. I saw a role model. And many have come since then, like Billy Higgins. Billy Higgins is a great drummer from Los Angeles who recorded with everybody, but he had a space called the World Stage, and it was a community space that musicians could come and practice, meet other musicians, artists. It's right in the middle of Leimert Park, and so I spent a lot of time there, and I watched this man put his money where his mouth is. Hmm. He toured all over the world and took his money and put it right back in the community, and I'm the product of a young man who went through that. So he was a very important role model. It's really been those who have been role models more so than the work. You know, the work to me is, you know, I'm always going to be excited by new work and past work. But when an individual really makes a change in a community, that's a working artist. Like Nina Simone inspires me by not only by the music that she makes, but by her defense of our music. Duke Ellington inspires me. Louis Armstrong. These people were not only musicians, but they were also activists, and they made very significant changes in American culture, not only through their music, but letters to Eisenhower, like Louis Armstrong did, demanding that he send the National Guard to escort the Little Rock 9 into Central High School. So that is what inspires me, because their work is great, and I think we can all admit Louis Armstrong was a great artist. Mm-hmm. But what made him a great person and an artist was how he stepped out and defended his community and defended his music.
Hmm. Sean?
Come on, I mean, it would be hard to say. I mean, I think the thing is it's pretty present, right? This notion of how do you reflect the world? For me, this notion, I'm a grown man, supposedly, and the ideas of identity and race, I would say I wouldn't go so far as to say they're a daily obsession, but They're in my head every day, so I don't have a defining moment that was, Eureka, I put the pick through the wall and I figured it all out. I mean, I think the more there have been many moments along the way where you see these these reflections, again, of the world, and they're, you know, oftentimes for me they're reflected back in music, you know, like an album, like when we were younger, when African Bambaataa came out with that Zulu Nation, just the concept of these guys that could remake their world and define who they were and who their brothers were and who their crew was a very far out concept for a kid. And I wasn't like a gang kid, but there was this notion that it was like, yeah, we have like super qualities too. Like, yeah, we can see beyond our block too. Yeah, we're like cartoons too. And I think, you know, as it progressed in my life, you know, like when, you know, War's album, World is a Ghetto, it's a great one just because it's like, bam, there's this black and white photo. And you go like, all right, you know, when they say the ghetto, oh, that's, yeah, right, that's, oh, some, there's an album and I can purchase this album and this band will play at the festivals and hundreds and thousands of people will see them. And the stories that they're telling, you know, like Cisco Kid, like, who didn't know a dude named Cisco? Who didn't eat salty peanuts off the can? Everyone did. And you go like, oh, wow, that's really crazy. Like, my life, you know, what my aunties prepare, is that's like real life. Or like, for me, just I think generationally, too, when Prince's Sign of the Times album came out was a big thing for me. Again, just I think there's something about the sort of collage, even pictures that are collages, like a Bearden paint. Like when I first saw Bearden stuff, I was like, yes, that's what the world looks like. You know, it's collage and ripped up, and I can see just a piece of that person, and just a piece of that reminds me of things. So things like that I still really respond to. And I think, you know, like, I mean, obviously there are great masters. I mean, you mentioned August Wilson is like probably the greatest sort of recorder of the musicality of our voice and storytelling that I think I've heard. But certainly there are great masters, and we all know those. I think there's something about music and dance for me, too, that can reflect the sort of fluidity of it. I mean, if you guys ever see, you know, almost anything that Bill T. Jones does or Rennie Harris, Pure Movement, there's something about where it's just energetically, and on top of all that, the people look like people in the real world. And that's real important for me, I think, having grown up and not seeing a lot of people that, I guess, look like me.
Great. Thank you so much. You know, we always seem to talk about race, and that has a connotation that there's something negative coming, like racial wars. Thomas talked about earlier, racial wounding. Are there instances where race and art could bring people together? Have you guys ever thought about that? This is a question I haven't asked them before. Oh, I thought her sculptures was the preface to the whole questioning, but thank you. They're not forgetting you, Joyce. What? Do you want to answer about...
What's your favorite?
I forgot the...
what piece
of artwork affected you personally...
I just spoke on that. You weren't paying attention.
Right. Great. I want to make sure you didn't forget.
Sherry,
that.
You were right. You were wrong.
I talked about the hands that pick cotton at the white sculpture.
Right. Okay. But do you have any instance or concepts of how race could bring art and art brings people together?
Well, I think that. Yes, it can get people talking. I think I just said that when I was talking about Ed DeWitt's exhibit. And then there have been other exhibits that evoked emotions when people... There was an exhibit in the gallery with Michael Platt, and the title of the exhibit was Abandoned Places. And one of the pictures was a woman in chains in the slave castles. And then another was a woman in a room in the home in Katrina when the places were destroyed.
What was your question?
My question was, how can we bring people together?
Oh, so I think how you bring people together with art, which is why I have a very diverse group of artists, and there's a very diverse group of people who come through the gallery. So for different exhibits, different art pieces, it raises questions. People have questions about it. And when you have questions about it, then you have discussion about it. I had an exhibit with an all-women's exhibit, and there was African, Asian, China, everybody. And so in doing so, it just brings about conversation. And when you have conversation, then a lot of those questions that you may have had or a lot of those fears that you may have had can be addressed just through conversation. But you have to see the artwork first.
Let's go to Sean.
Yeah. I work mainly in performance field, so I think I've seen a lot of I think part of the point of it is the act of communing, like we're doing here. We're all in the same world together, even if for the 60 minutes is a very helpful and hopefully, you know, has the potential to heal. There are these performances I've seen. You had mentioned the Lorraine Hansberry Theater. One of the things that I love so much about what Stanley Williams and Quentin Easter used to do, they would call out friends that were in the audience, and before the show, you know, just like, hey, Thomas, you're here. Hey, I'm glad you made it. Things like these really simple humanizing things are really, I find it very touching, very moving. And then you get presented with a piece of art. And then that experience of communing, of congregating, of just talking, and then, you know, all these questions come up when you see a piece of work, and then you leave. And this great artist, Roger Genevieve Smith, incredible performer, one of the big shows that he did was a Huey P. Newton story. And I must have seen that thing like 15 times. And I can go on and on about the work, but what I found most amazing about it, he would do this thing, it was like a set, 80-minute set, where he would do Huey P. Newton's life, just him on stage. And it was like, in terms of like tour de force, it was really just an amazing thing. But the really moving thing was after the show, just like church, he would stand at the door and he would greet you. He would shake every single person's hand in it. And I know it might sound a little corny like that. So what? He shook. But this was the guy that had just transformed before your eyes. He was kind of dripping with sweat still. And the most important, seemingly in that moment, the most important thing for him was just that he looked you in the eye and said, thank you for coming. You looked at him, you go, thank you for doing your thing, Roger, or whatever you did. And I think that part of the live act is pretty interesting. I think Marcus said something earlier, which is the much more difficult thing, is like, how do you talk about it? How do you talk about it if no one in this country wants to talk about it? So, like, it's really hard to get it to the healing point if we don't sort of work through the scabs and the cuts and the bruises. And that's the real hard part, and that's the part I have no idea other than to keep trying to throw up more questions.
Well, I actually think that I'm not sure how art brings people together. I just think art has to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And that just means that the mm-hmm. artist has to create from a foundation of truth. And so if that is happening, then you're exposing the greatness that exists in all of us. Mm-hmm. That alone should bring people together. If it doesn't, people aren't going to come together because a piece of work is, to me, it's really about art telling the truth. Nina Simone talks about this a lot. Louis Armstrong talks about this a lot. Emily Dickinson, in her work, it was the raw truth. She created poems that spoke of racial tension. One of her poems, I think, is called Color Caste Denomination, speaks about race at a time when people weren't really particularly, you know, she was a Quaker, and we're talking mid-19th century, but she was writing about the truth about how we have these walls separated by race, but when we die, you know, all of that goes away, okay? When we go to sleep, she talks about in her poem, race even evaporates. We're all kind of in one in this sense. So people like her, and then the blues singers who came in the turn of the century, people like Bessie Smith, people like Ma Rainey, Clara Smith. It was like five Smith sisters. None of them was their real names. Those are their stage names, but they were making so much money with this Bessie Smith, Mamie Smith. Bessie Smith sold almost 6 million records at a time. They were called race records. We're talking about the topic of race. We'll see how our country has been divided by race since the beginning. They had these things called race records, you know, recorded and sold to the black community to be consumed by the black community only. Yet white folks was buying this music too, because the music was brutally honest. This is the first time African-American women really were owning their sexuality, their body, their sense of self-purpose through their work. Prior to that, you know, they were either enslaved or owned by somebody else. But through these songs, they talked about things that nobody talked about before. Their work was brutally honest. In doing that, it paved the way for the women's rights movement that didn't come till later, 1960. It paved the way for people like Louis Armstrong to record 10 years later, because their work was brutally honest. Bessie Smith sang about things from homosexuality to abuse. She sang about everything and things that people only talked about in private. She exposed it and made it a public problem, therefore making it a community solution, because her work was brutally honest. So I think if artists do that, and we have plenty of examples of that, from Langston Hughes on up to Alvin Ailey and the work that he creates on up, to James Baldwin and the work that he wrote on up. If those works, Duke Ellington, don't want to forget about him, he wrote a piece called Black, Brown, and Beige. And this piece, brutally honest, once again, was the vision of African-American existence through the Middle Passage, through slavery, the Reconstruction, current time for him, which would have been the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and then in the future, how he saw this valiant race who had came from, who were enslaved and had educated themselves, built their community. Again, the honesty brought people together to me in the work that they created, and that's really, I think, what can bring people together.
I think that's basically the same thing I was saying, but I was not saying that all artwork or all paintings or sculptures will evoke conversation. And I think that when each artist does a piece, he is speaking his truth. He is speaking from his or her experience, or he is speaking from his history. So,
well, we're going to turn it back to Thomas Simpson.
Thank you very, very much. I'd like to remind our listening audience that this program of the Commonwealth Club, that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club. I'm Thomas Robert Simpson from the Member-Led Arts Forum. You're listening to a panel in association with Afro Solo Arts Festival on the role the arts have played in exploring race-related issues. We do have some questions from the audience. I have passed some of them to Sherry. We will now go into those questions. If you have others, please hand them in.
Thomas, I'd just like to say thank you. I'd be traveling 5 hours.
This is not the right time right now. Okay.
I just want to say, passion is in fashion. Thank you to all of you. Artists are like gardeners. They're closer.
Thank you, sir.
But what I wanted to share with you real quick.
Actually, we don't have the time right now. This is not the right forum to do that, but we thank you for your comment. What I would like to do is actually pass this first question over to Joyce. Joyce, how do people perceive your gallery being a black owner? Does it affect what type of work people assume you should exhibit? How does it play in Oakland arts today? We talked about this.
Let me see this question.
You want to decipher the handwriting?
Well, I think when I first opened the gallery, most people assume that or perceive the gallery as a black art gallery, meaning that I only show artwork by black artists. And then there are other people who perceive the gallery as being a, I guess, white-owned gallery because I show a lot of abstract paintings. So...
How does it play in Oakland art?
So, actually, I think I'm a blessing to Oakland at this time. If I must say so myself. From the time that I opened the gallery 10 years ago, there was probably about 3 galleries in Oakland. Mm. So now, to date, there's probably about 35, 30 being white-owned galleries and 5 being black. Now in Oakland, and I think it's happening all across the country, the art scene is just really big. In Oakland, the uptown area from Grand Avenue to 25th Street has been designated as the Arts and Entertainment District. In that district, there's about 26 galleries and 1 black-owned gallery. And then when you come down Telegraph towards Grand Avenue, of course, that's not Grand Avenue, Broadway, that's where I am. So... I say all that to say that there's still a really big divide in the arts in this country. We'll have that conversation again.
It's only 60 minutes, so we can't solve the rhyme. That's all right. So I'm going to ask our panelists to possibly comment on these questions, if you have a comment, briefly. I have a question, and one is similar to the other, so I'll read the first one I received. Now that you realize that the outside world perceives you in certain ways, can you ignore these perceptions and free yourself to form your own perspectives? Who would like to comment on that? Sean? I feel like a teacher. Sean, come to the front.
Did you think I wasn't paying attention? I was. It's a hard question. You know, I think Shelby really opened up my head when he said that thing, you know, the job is to tell the truth. So I think that encapsulates it for me. I think that is the task at hand. I mean, even in the sort of make-believe world of arts, I still think at the root of it is to tell the truth.
Marcus or Joyce?
Well, I will say that at least for me, I don't really worry about how people perceive me. I kind of want to own my own identity, and part of that is being educated. I have 2 mm-hmm. daughters, and so much of what I try to at least evoke is a sense of self, a sense of community, a sense of history, mm-hmm. and not try to worry about how I'm perceived as a person, because you'll be changing every day.
Yeah. All right. Joyce, do you have anything to put into this, or do you want to... All right. Oh, she goes. All right. Since we're in a political cycle right here, we have a political question. Mitt Romney likes to talk about how important culture is in shaping destiny. By extension, race is also destiny. But that does not take into consideration the tensions between culture and race and oppression, racism. How has this tension informed your work?
How has racial tension
right.
informed my work? Well, part of it is try to understand where it came from, you know, and doing that requires some research, requires some asking of questions. And it requires, you know, going to sources. I mean, we're in a situation now. We have states that are rewriting history books, Texas, Arizona. We have situation where states are passing voter suppression laws. You know, we're right back in the 1930s again. We have states that are enacting laws where you have to have an ID. We're back to poll taxes again. It's more urgent than ever than the artist to tell the truth, all right? Because as we see that the same old tricks are up again. And just like Coltrane, and just like Nina Simone, and just like Dorothy Dunnigan and Miles Davis was able to combat that with their blues, we have to do that today. Again, the blues is the pursuit of freedom, okay? It is the most authentic weapon we have in this country. It defines this country, this music called the blues that started in slavery and defined and refined by people like Harriet Tubman. It's been used. It's self-expression. It's the most perfect example of a musical. The blues is the perfect example of democracy because everybody's voice is necessary for it to reach its potential. And if you don't have that, then you have a failed democracy. And right now, when they're trying to suppress the vote, pass poll taxes, redraw districts so that people stay in office forever, okay, then we need the blues once again to come to the rescue, like it did for Harriet Tubman and Dr. Martin Luther King and all those who came before us.
Great. Thank you. Sean or Joyce, do you have any ringing in about this political dynamic, cultural?
I'm not going to follow that.
All right.
Trying to cast all my right. vote for Shelby.
All right. All right. Well, we have two cards actually about ACC's Scottsboro's Boys. So one card says, the controversial Scottsboro's Boys recently left. I refuse to see it, for it appears that the creativity was from a white perspective, especially the minstrel dancing, singing. Do you think an African-American would have made a difference? And let me read the second card about the same subject. What are your thoughts on ACT's recent production of the Scottsboro's Boys juxtaposed with this production of Race last season? Sean, did you see either one?
Yeah.
Great. Why don't you make a comment?
Well, I mean, Race is, for those on the radio, I just wipe my hand away like, whatever, like Race. I'm not even going to comment on that one. But the one that's more interesting is the one, the Scottsboro Boys, because it's about a historical actual event. And I think the minstrel thing, I think you would have to see it in order to get the vibe of it. But I actually thought that was the most pressing kind of part of the presentation. There's a moment, here, I'll spoil the whole play for you, right at the end of the show where they're sort of urged. The boys are urged to perform a minstrel show, and they do it, and they don't play along with it, and then they wipe their face off. And it's a very deep moment, about 2 minutes of a, I don't know, 2-hour show or something. So, you know, I say, you know, you do a show for 1,500 people, it's not going to be challenging. So okay. How are we going to get to that point of
Thomas is pulling on my shoulder. He's like, it comes to me first. All right. Mm-hmm. And now Thomas Simpson.
Unfortunately, we're coming to the close of our hour. We have time for one last question. We would like to have really succinct answers to this question, if you can.
The last question is, in your estimation, what are a few simple things Americans can do to improve race relations among Americans? In just 2 minutes or less.
Yeah. What are two things they can do?
No, just what are a few things?
A few things.
Really or succinctly. Real succinctly.
If you can't think of anything.
I can think of something.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Again, we have to tell the truth. We have to tell the truth. Look, we can't even have a conversation in this country about guns. Because no one wants to talk about it. And we just had a tragedy last week. We had a tragedy a couple months ago. There was a tragedy in Sweden. We can't even have a truthful conversation. That is part of what is a problem in America. So race, we ain't never really had that conversation. President Obama tried to have it 4 years ago when he gave his big race speech. That was like, wow, okay, we about ready to have that conversation, y'all. And then we didn't.
All right. Anyone else? All right. I think we're done.
Thank you.
I would like to thank Sherry Young, our moderator. Joyce Jordan, our gallery operator, owner. our musician, Marcus Shelby.
Yes, sir.
Our theater person, Sean San Jose.
Thank you, young man.
And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.